Side 22, It, by Stephen King. Continuing on page 818. 4. Little by little, Beverly got herself under control again. She knew she had to get out. Beating a retreat was ultimately less dangerous than hanging around. They were absorbed in what they were doing, and even if worse came to worst, she could get a head start. And in the back of her mind, she had also decided that if worst came to terrible, a few shots from the bullseye might discourage them. She was about to begin creeping away when Victor said, "I gotta go, Henry. My dad wants me to help him pick corn this afternoon." "Oh, shit," Henry said. "He'll live." "No, he's mad at me because of what happened the other day." "Fuck him if he can't take a joke." Beverly listened more closely now, suspecting it might be the scuffle which had ended with Eddie's broken arm that they were talking about. "No, I gotta go." "I think his ass hurts," Patrick said. "Watch your mouth, fuckface," Victor said. "It might grow on you." "I got to go, too," Belch said. "Your father want you to pick corn?" Henry asked angrily. This was what might have passed for a jest in Henry's mind. Belch's father was dead. "No, but I got a job delivering the weekly shopper. I gotta do that tonight." "What's this weekly shopper crap?" Henry asked, now sounding upset as well as angry. "It's a job," Belch said with ponderous patience. "I make money." Henry made a disgusted sound, and Beverly risked another peek around the car. Victor and Belch were standing, buckling their belts. Henry and Patrick were still squatting with their pants down. The lighter glinted in Henry's hand. "You're not chickening out, are you?" Henry asked Patrick. "Nope," Patrick said. "You don't have to pick corn or go do some pussy job." "Nope," Patrick said again. "Well," Belch said uncertainly, "see you around, Henry." "Sure," Henry said, and spat near one of Belch's clod-hopping work shoes. Vic and Belch started off together toward the two rows of wrecked cars, toward the Studebaker behind which Beverly was crouching. At first she could only cringe, frozen with fear like a rabbit. Then she slid around the left side of the Studebaker and back down the gap between it and the battered doorless Ford next to it. For a moment she paused, looking from side to side, hearing them approach. She hesitated, her mouth cottony dry, her back itchy with sweat. A part of her mind was numbly wondering how she'd look in a cast like Eddie's with the loser's name signed on it. Then she dived into the Ford on the passenger side. She curled up on the filthy floor mat, making herself as small as possible. It was boiling hot inside the junked-out Ford, and it smelled so thickly of dust, rotting upholstery, and elderly rat crap that she had to struggle grimly to keep from sneezing or coughing. She heard Belch and Victor pass close by, talking in low voices. Then they were gone. She sneezed three times, quickly and quietly, into her cupped hands. She supposed she could go now if she was careful. The best way to do it would be to shift over to the driver's side of the Ford, sneak back to the aisle, and then just do a fade. She believed she could manage it, but the shock of almost being discovered had robbed her of her courage, at least for the time being. She felt safer here in the Ford. And maybe now that Victor and Belch had gone, the other two would also go soon. Then she could go back to the clubhouse. She had lost all interest in target shooting. Also, she had to pee. "Come on," she thought. "Come on, hurry up and go, hurry up and go. Please." A moment later, she heard Patrick roar with mixed laughter and pain. 6 feet, Henry bellowed. "Just like a fucking blowtorch, swear to God." Silence then for a while. Sweat trickling down her back. The sun beating through the Ford's cracked windshield on the nape of her neck. Heaviness in her bladder. Henry bellowed so loud that Beverly, who had been close to dozing in spite of her discomfort, almost cried out herself. "Damn it, Hockstetter, you burned my frigging ass. What are you doing with that lighter?" 10 feet, Patrick giggled. Just the sound of it made Bev feel cold and revolted, as if she had seen a worm squirm its way out of her salad. 10 feet if it was an inch, Henry. Bright blue. 10 feet if it was an inch, swear to God. "Give me that," Henry grunted. Come on, you stupid nicks, go, get out." When Patrick spoke again, his voice was so low Bev could barely hear it. If there had been the slightest breath of wind on the air that baking afternoon, he would not have done.
"Let me show you something," Patrick said.
"What?" Henry asked.
"Just something,"
Patrick paused. "It feels good."
"What?"
Henry asked again. Then there was silence.
"I don't want to look," I don't want to see what they're doing now. And besides, they might see me. In fact, they probably will because you've used up all your luck today, girlio. So just stay right here. No peeking.
But her curiosity had overcome her good sense. There was something strange in that silence, something a little bit scary. She raised her head inch by inch until she could look through the forge's cracked, cloudy windshield. She needn't have worried about being seen. Both of the boys were concentrating on what Patrick was doing. She didn't understand what she was seeing, but she knew it was nasty. Not that she would have expected anything else from Patrick, who was just so weird. He had one hand between Henry's thighs and one hand between his own. One hand was flogging Henry's thing gently. With his other hand, Patrick was rubbing his own. Except he wasn't exactly rubbing it. He was kind of squeezing it, pulling it, letting it flop back down. What is he doing? Beverly wondered, dismayed. She didn't know, not for sure, but it scared her. She didn't think she had been this scared since the blood had vomited out of the bathroom drain and splattered all over everything. Some deep part of her cried out that if they discovered she had seen this, whatever it was, they might do more than hurt her. They might actually kill her. Still, she couldn't look away. She saw that Patrick's thing had gotten a little longer, but not much. It still dangled between his legs like a snake with no backbone. Henry's, however, had grown amazingly. It stood up stiff and hard, almost poking his belly button. Patrick's hand went up and down, sometimes pausing to squeeze, sometimes tickling that odd heavy sack under Henry's thing. Those are his balls, Beverly thought. Do boys have to go around with those all the time? God, I go crazy. Another part of her mind then whispered, Bill has those. On its own, her mind visualized her holding them, cupping them in her hand, testing their texture, and that hot feeling raced through her again, sparking off a furious blush. Henry stared at Patrick's hand as if hypnotized. His lighter lay on the rocky scree beside him, reflecting hot afternoon sun. Want me to put it in my mouth? Patrick asked. His big livery lips smiled complacently. Huh? Henry asked, as if startled from some deep dream. I'll put it in my mouth if you want. Henry's hand flashed out, half-curled, not quite a fist. Patrick was knocked sprawling. His head thudded on the gravel. Beverly dived down again, her heart crashing in her chest, her teeth locked against a little whimpering moan. After knocking Patrick down, Henry had turned, and for a moment, just before she dropped back into her little huddled ball on the passenger side of the drive shaft hump, it seemed that her eyes and Henry's had locked. Please, God, the sun was in his eyes, she prayed. Please, God, I'm sorry I peeked. Please, God. There was an agonizing pause then. Her white blouse was plastered to her body with sweat. Droplets like seed pearls gleamed on her tanned arms. Her bladder throbbed painfully. She felt that very soon she would wet her pants. She waited for Henry's furious, crazy face to appear in the opening where the Ford's passenger door had been, sure it was going to happen. How could he have missed seeing her? He would drag her out and hurt her. He would... A new and even more terrible thought now occurred to her, and once again she had to engage in a painful, crampy struggle to keep from wetting her pants. Suppose he did something to her with his thing. Suppose he wanted her to put it in her somewhere. She knew where it was supposed to go, all right. It seemed that knowledge had suddenly sprung into her mind full-blown. She thought that if Henry tried to put his thing in her, she would go crazy. Please, no, please, God, don't let him have seen me, please, okay? Then Henry spoke, and to her growing horror, his voice was coming from someplace much closer. I don't go for that queer stuff. From farther off, Patrick's voice.
You liked it.
I didn't like it, Henry shouted, and if you tell anyone I did, I'll kill you, you fucking little pansy.
You got a boner, Patrick said.
He sounded like he was smiling. As much as she feared Henry Bowers, the smile would not have surprised Beverly. Patrick was crazy, crazier than Henry, maybe, and people that crazy weren't afraid of anything.
I saw it.
Footsteps crunched over the gravel, closer and closer. Beverly looked up, her eyes bulging. Through the Ford's old windshield, she could now see the back of Henry's head. He was looking toward Patrick now, but if he turned around... If you tell anyone, I'll say you're a cocksucker, Henry said. Then I'll kill you.
You don't scare me, Henry, Patrick said and giggled. But I might not tell if you gave me a dollar.
Henry shifted restlessly. He turned slightly. Beverly could now see one quarter of his profile instead of just the back of his head.
please, God, please, God, she begged incoherently, and her bladder throbbed more strongly. If you tell, Henry said, his voice low and deliberate, I'll tell what you've been doing with the cats, with the dogs, too. I'll tell them about your refrigerator. You know what'll happen, Hochstetter? They'll come and take you away and put you into the fucking A loony bin. Silence from Patrick. Henry drummed his fingers on the hood of the Ford Beverly was hiding in. Do you hear me? I hear you. Patrick sounded sullen now, sullen and a little scared. He burst out, You liked it. You got a boner. Biggest boner I ever saw. Yeah, I'll bet you've seen a lot of them, you fucking little homo faggot. You just remember what I said about the refrigerator. Your refrigerator. And if I see you around again, I'll knock your block off. More silence from Patrick. Henry moved away. Beverly turned her head and saw him pass by the driver's side of the Ford. If he had looked to his left even a little bit, he would have seen her. But he didn't look. A moment later, she heard him heading off the way Victor and Belch had gone. Now there was just Patrick. Beverly waited, but nothing happened. 5 minutes dragged by. Her need to urinate was now desperate. She might be able to hold out for another 2 or 3 minutes, but no more. And it made her uneasy not to know for sure where Patrick was. She peeked through the windshield again and saw him just sitting there. Henry had forgotten his lighter. Patrick had put his school books back into a small canvas carrier sack and had slung it around his neck like a newsboy's, but his pants and underpants were still down around his ankles. He was playing with the lighter. He would spin the wheel, produce a flame that was almost invisible in the bright day, snap the lighter closed, and then start all over again. He seemed hypnotized. A line of blood ran from the corner of his mouth to his chin, and his lips were swelling up on the right side. He seemed not to notice, and once again Beverly felt a squirmy sort of revulsion. Patrick was crazy, all right. She had never in her life wanted so badly to get away from someone. Moving very carefully, she crawled backward over the Ford's drive shaft hump and squeezed under the steering wheel. She put her feet out on the ground and crept to the back of the Ford. Then she ran quickly back the way she had come. When she had entered the pines beyond the junked cars, she looked back over her shoulder. No one was there. The dump dozed in the sun. She felt the bands of tension around her chest and stomach loosen with relief, and all that was left was the need to urinate, so great that she now felt sick with it. She hurried down the path a short way and then ducked off to the right. She had her shorts unsnapped almost before the underbrush had closed behind her again. She took a quick look around to make sure there was no poison ivy at hand. Then she squatted, holding the tough trunk of a bush for balance. She was pulling her shorts up again when she heard approaching footsteps from the dump. All she could see through the bushes were flashes of blue denim and the faded plaid of a school shirt. It was Patrick. She ducked down, waiting for him to pass by toward Kansas Street. She was more sanguine about her position here. The cover was good, she no longer had to pee, and Patrick was off in his own cuckoo world. When he was gone, she would double back and head for the clubhouse. But Patrick didn't pass by. He stopped on the path almost directly opposite her and stood looking at the rusting Amana refrigerator. Beverly could observe Patrick along a natural sight line in the bushes without too much chance of being seen. Now that she was relieved, she found she was curious again. And if Patrick did happen to see her, she felt certain she could outrun him. He wasn't as fat as Ben, but he was podgy. She pulled the bullseye out of her back pocket, however, and put half a dozen steel pellets in the breast pocket of her old Ship and Shore. Crazy or not, a good one to the knee might discourage the likes of Patrick Hochstetter in a hurry. She remembered the refrigerator well enough now. There were lots of discarded fridges at the dump, but it suddenly occurred to her that this was the only one she'd seen which Mandy Fazio hadn't disarmed by either tearing out the latching mechanism with pliers or simply removing the door altogether. Patrick began to hum and sway back and forth in front of the rusty old refrigerator, and Beverly felt a fresh chill course through her. He was like a guy in a horror movie trying to summon a dead body out of a crypt. What's he up to? But if she had known that, or what was going to happen when Patrick finished his private ritual and opened the dead Amana's rusty door, she would have run away as fast as she could. 5. No one, not even Mike Hanlon, had the slightest idea of how crazy Patrick Hochstetter really was. He was 12, the son of a paint salesman.
His mother was a devout Catholic who would die of breast cancer in 1962, 4 years after Patrick was consumed by the dark entity which existed in and below Derry. Although his IQ tested out as low normal, Patrick had already repeated 2 grades, the first and third. He was taking summer classes this year, so he would not have to repeat the fifth as well. His teachers found him an apathetic student. This several of them noted on the bare 6 lines of the Derry Elementary School's report cards reserved for teachers' comments. And a rather disturbing one as well, which none noted. Their feelings were too vague, too diffuse, to be expressed in 60 lines, let alone 6. If he had been born 10 years later, a guidance counselor might have steered him toward a child psychologist who might, or might not, Patrick was far more clever than his lackluster IQ results indicated, have realized the frightening depths behind that slack and pallid moon face. He was a sociopath, and perhaps by that hot July in 1958, he had become a full-fledged psychopath. He could not remember a time when he had believed that other people, any other living creatures for that matter, were real. He believed himself to be an actual creature, probably the only one in the universe, but was by no means convinced that his actuality made him real. He had no sense of hurting exactly, and no real sense of being hurt. His indifference to being struck in the mouth by Henry in the dump was a case in point. But while he found reality a totally meaningless concept, he understood the concept of rules perfectly. And while all of his teachers had found him odd, both Mrs. Douglas, his fifth grade teacher, and Mrs. Weems, who had had Patrick in the third grade, knew about the pencil box full of flies, and while neither of them totally ignored the implications, each had between 20 and 28 other students, each with problems of his or her own. None of them had serious disciplinary problems with him. He might turn in test papers that were utterly blank, or blank except for a large decorative question mark. And Mrs. Douglas had discovered it was best to keep him away from the girls because of his Roman hands and Russian fingers. But he was quiet. So quiet that there were times when he might have been taken for a big lump of clay that had been crudely fashioned to look like a boy. It was easy to ignore Patrick, who failed quietly, when you had to cope with boys like Henry Bowers and Victor Chris, who were actively disruptive and insolent, boys who would steal milk money or happily deface school property if given a chance, and girls like the unfortunately named Elizabeth Taylor, who was epileptic and whose few poor brain cells worked only sporadically, and who had to be discouraged from pulling her dresses up in the play yard to show off a new pair of panties. In other words, Derry Elementary School was the typical confused educational carnival, a circus with so many rings that Pennywise himself might have gone unnoticed. Certainly none of Patrick's teachers, or his parents for that matter, suspected that, when he was 5, Patrick had murdered his baby brother Avery. Patrick had not liked it when his mother brought Avery home from the hospital. He didn't care, or so he at first told himself, if his parents had 2 kids, 5 kids, or 5 dozen kids, as long as the kid or kids didn't alter his own schedule. But he found that Avery did. Meals came late. The baby cried in the night and woke him up. It seemed that his parents were always hanging over its crib, and often when he tried to get their attention, he found that he could not. For one of the few times in his life, Patrick became frightened. It occurred to him that if his parents had brought him, Patrick, home from the hospital, and if he was real, then Avery might be real too. It might even be that, when Avery got big enough to walk and talk, to bring in his father's copy of the Derry News from the front step, and to hand his mother the bowls when she baked bread, they might decide to get rid of Patrick altogether. It was not that he feared they loved Avery more, although it was obvious to Patrick that they did love him more, and in this case his judgment was probably correct. What he cared about was, 1, the rules that were being broken or had changed since Avery's arrival, 2, Avery's possible reality, and 3, the possibility that they might throw him out in favor of Avery. Patrick went into Avery's room one afternoon around 2:30, shortly after the school bus had dropped him off from his afternoon kindergarten session. It was January. Outside, snow was beginning to fall. A powerful wind boomed across McCarran Park and rattled the frosty upstairs storm windows. His mother was napping in her bedroom. Avery had been fussy all the previous night. His father was at work. Avery was sleeping on his stomach, his head turned to one side. Patrick, his moon face expressionless, turned Avery's head so his face was pressed directly into the pillow. Avery made a snuffling noise and turned his head back to the side. Patrick observed this and stood thinking about it while the snow melted off his yellow boots and puddled on the floor. Perhaps 5 minutes passed. Quick thinking was not Patrick's specialty. And then he turned Avery's face into the pillow again and held it there for a moment. Avery stirred under his hand, struggling, but his struggles were weak. Patrick let go. Avery turned his head to the side again, made one snorting little cry, and then went on sleeping. The wind gusted, rattling the windows. Patrick waited to see if the one little cry would awaken his mother. It didn't. Now he felt swept by a great excitement. The world seemed to stand out in front of him clearly for the first time. His emotional equipment was severely defective, and in those few moments he felt as a totally colorblind person might feel if given a shot which enabled him to perceive colors for a short time. Or as a junkie who has just fixed feels as the smack rockets his brain into orbit. This was a new thing. He had not suspected it existed. Very gently, he turned Avery's face into the pillow again. This time when Avery struggled, Patrick did not let go. He pressed the baby's face more firmly into the pillow. The baby was making steady, muffled cries now, and Patrick knew it was awake. He had a vague idea that it might tell on him to his mother if he stopped. He held it down. The baby struggled. Patrick held it down. The baby farted. Its struggles weakened. Patrick still held it down. It eventually became totally still. Patrick held it down for another 5 minutes, feeling that excitement crest and then begin to ebb. The shot wearing off, turning the world gray again, the fix mellowing into an accustomed low doze. Patrick went downstairs and got himself a plate of cookies and poured himself a glass of milk. His mother came down half an hour later and said she hadn't even heard him come in. She had been that tired. "You won't be any more, Mom," Patrick thought. "Don't worry, I fixed it." She sat down with him, ate one of his cookies, and asked him how school had been. Patrick said it was all right and showed her his drawing of a house and a tree. His paper was covered with looping, meaningless scribbles made with black and brown crayon. His mother said it was very nice. Patrick brought home the same looping scrawls of black and brown every day. Sometimes he said it was a turkey, sometimes a Christmas tree, sometimes a boy. His mother always told him it was very nice. Although sometimes, in a part of her so deep she hardly knew it was there, she worried. There was something a little disquieting about the dark sameness of those big scribbled loops of black and brown. She didn't discover Avery's death until nearly 5 o'clock. Until then, she had simply assumed he was taking a very long nap. By then, Patrick was watching Crusader Rabbit on their 7-inch TV, and he went on watching TV through all the uproar that followed. Whirlybirds was on when Mrs. Henley arrived from next door. His screaming mother had been holding the baby's corpse in the open kitchen door, believing in some blind way that the cold air might revive it. Patrick was cold and got a sweater out of the downstairs closet. Highway Patrol, Ben Hanscom's favorite, was on when Mr. Hochstetter arrived home from work. By the time the doctor arrived, Science Fiction Theater, with your host Truman Bradley, was just coming on. "Who knows what strange things the universe may hold," Truman Bradley speculated, while Patrick's mother shrieked and struggled in her husband's arms in the kitchen. The doctor observed Patrick's deep calm and unquestioning stare and assumed the boy was in shock. He wanted Patrick to take a pill. Patrick didn't mind. It was diagnosed as crib death. Years later, there might have been questions about such a fatality, deviations from the usual infant death syndrome observed. But when it happened, the death was simply noted and the baby buried. Patrick was gratified that once things finally settled down, his meals began to come on time again. In the madness of that afternoon and evening, people banging in and out of the house, the red lights of the home hospital ambulance pulsing on the walls, Mrs. Hochstetter screaming and wailing and refusing to be comforted, only Patrick's father came within brushing distance of the truth. He was standing numbly by Avery's empty crib some 20 minutes after the body had been removed, simply standing there, unable to believe any of this had happened. He looked down and saw a pair of tracks on the hardwood floor. They had been made by the snow melting off Patrick's yellow rubber boots. He looked at them, and a dreadful thought rose briefly in his mind like bad gas from a deep mine shaft. His hand went slowly to his mouth and his eyes widened. A picture began to form in his mind. Before it could come clear, he left the room, slamming the door behind him so hard that the top of the frame splintered. He never asked Patrick any questions. Patrick had never done anything like that again, although he might have done so if the chance had presented itself. He felt no guilt, had no bad dreams. As time passed, however, he became more aware of what would have happened to him if he had been caught. There were rules. Unpleasant things happened to you if you didn't follow them, or if you were caught breaking them. You could be locked up or stuck in the electrocution chair. But that remembered feeling of excitement, that feeling of color and sensation, was simply too powerful and too wonderful to give over entirely. Patrick killed flies. At first he only smacked them with his mother's fly swatter. Later he discovered he could kill them quite efficiently with a plastic ruler. He also discovered the joys of fly paper. A long sticky runner of it could be purchased for 2 cents at the Costello Avenue market, and Patrick sometimes stood for as long as 2 hours in the garage, watching the flies land and then struggle to get free, his mouth ajar, his dusty eyes alight with that rare excitement, sweat running down his round face and his thick body. Patrick killed beetles, but if possible, he captured them first. Sometimes he would steal a long needle from his mother's pincushion, impale a Japanese beetle on it, and sit cross-legged in the garden watching it die. His expression at these times was the expression of a boy who was reading a very good book. Once he had discovered a run-over cat that was dying in the gutter on Lower Main Street, and sat watching it until an old woman saw him pushing the squashed and mewing thing around with his foot. She whacked him with the broom she had been using to sweep her walk. "Go on home," she had shouted at him. "What are you, crazy?" Patrick had gone on home. He wasn't mad at the old woman. He had been caught breaking the rules, that was all. Then last year, it would not have surprised Mike Hanlon or any of the others at that point to have known that it was, in fact, on the same day that George Denbrough had been murdered. Patrick had discovered the rusty Amana refrigerator, one of the larger dumpoids in the belt surrounding the dump itself. Like Bev, he had heard the cautionary warnings about such abandoned appliances, about how 30 squirty million kids got their stupid selves smoked in them each year. Patrick had stood looking at the refrigerator for a long time, idly playing pocket pool with himself. That excitement was back, stronger than it had ever been, except for the time he had fixed Avery. The excitement was back because, in the chilly yet fuming wastes that passed for his mind, Patrick Hockstetter had had an idea. The Luces, who lived 3 houses down from the Hockstetters, missed their cat Bobby a week later. The Luce kids, who couldn't remember a time when Bobby hadn't been there, spent hours combing the neighborhood for him. They even pooled their money and put an ad in the Derry News Lost and Found column. Nothing came of it. And if any of them had seen Patrick that day, bulkier than ever in his mothball-smelling winter parka, after the floodwaters receded in that fall of 57, it had come off bitterly cold almost at once, carrying a cardboard carton, they would have thought nothing of it. The Engstroms, a block over and almost directly behind the Hockstetter home, lost their cocker pup about 10 days before Thanksgiving. Other families lost dogs and cats over the next 6 or 8 months, and Patrick, of course, had taken them all, not to mention a dozen unremarked strays from the Hell's Half-Acre area of Derry. He put them into the rusty Amana near the dump, one by one. Each time he brought another animal down, his heart thundering in his chest, his eyes hot and watery with excitement, he would expect to find that Mandy Fazio had pulled the Amana's latch or popped the hinges with his sledgehammer. But Mandy never touched that particular refrigerator. Perhaps he didn't realize it was there. Perhaps the force of Patrick's will kept him away. Or perhaps some other force did that. The Engstrom's cocker lasted the longest. In spite of the single number cold, it was still alive when Patrick came back for the 3rd time in as many days. Although it had lost all of its friskiness, it had been wagging its tail and lapping his hands frantically when he originally hauled it out of the box and stuffed it into the refrigerator. When he came back a day after putting it in, the puppy had damn near gotten away. Patrick had to chase it almost all the way to the dump before he was able to jump it and get hold of one rear leg. The puppy had nipped Patrick with its sharp little teeth. Patrick didn't mind. In spite of the nips, he had taken the cocker back to the refrigerator and bundled it back in. He had a hard-on when he did it. This was not uncommon. On the 2nd day, the puppy had tried to get out again, but it moved much too slowly. Patrick shoved it back in, slammed the Amana's rusty door, and leaned against it. He could hear the puppy scratching against the door. He could hear its muffled whines.
Good dog, said Patrick Hockstetter.
His eyes were closed and he was breathing fast.
That's a good dog.
On the third day, the puppy could only roll its eyes toward Patrick's face when the door opened. Its sides were heaving rapidly and shallowly. When Patrick returned the next day, the cocker was dead with a cake of foam frozen around its mouth and muzzle. This made Patrick think of coconut popsicles, and he laughed quite hard as he hauled the frozen corpse from his killing bottle and threw it in the bushes. The supply of victims, which Patrick thought of, when he thought of them at all, as test animals, had been thin this summer. Questions of reality aside, his sense of self-preservation was well developed, his intuition exquisite. He suspected he was suspected. By whom, he was not sure. Mr. Engstrom? Perhaps. Mr. Engstrom had turned around and given Patrick a long, speculative look in the A&P one day this spring. Mr. Engstrom had been buying cigarettes and Patrick had been sent for bread. Mrs. Josephs? Maybe. She sat in her parlor window with a telescope sometimes and was, according to Mrs. Hockstetter, a nosy Parker. Mr. Jacobois, who had an ASPCA sticker on the back bumper of his car? Mr. Nell? Someone else? Patrick didn't know for sure, but his intuition told him he was suspected, and he never argued with his intuition. He had taken a few wandering animals from among the rotted tenements in the half acre, picking only those that looked thin or diseased, but that was all. He discovered, however, that the refrigerator near the dump had gotten an oddly powerful hold over him. He began to draw pictures of it in school when he was bored. He sometimes dreamed of it at night, and in his dreams the Amana was perhaps 70 feet tall, a whited sepulcher, a ponderous crypt iced in chilly moonlight. In these dreams, the giant door would swing open and he would see huge eyes staring out at him. He would awake in a cold sweat, but he found he could not give up the joys of the refrigerator entirely. Today he had finally found out who had suspected. Bowers. Knowing that Henry Bowers held the secret of his killing bottle in his hands left Patrick as close to panic as he was ever apt to get. This was not very close at all, in truth, but he still found this, not fear exactly, but mental unrest, oppressive and unpleasant. Henry knew that Patrick sometimes broke the rules. His latest victim had been a pigeon he discovered on Jackson Street 2 days ago. The pigeon had been struck by a car and couldn't fly. Patrick went home, got his box out of the garage, and put the pigeon inside. The pigeon pecked the back of Patrick's hand several times, leaving shallow, bloody digs. Patrick didn't mind. When he checked the refrigerator the next day, the pigeon had been quite dead. But Patrick hadn't removed the corpse then. Now, following Henry's threat to tell, Patrick decided he better get rid of the pigeon's body right away. Perhaps he would even get a bucket of water and some rags and scrub out the interior of the refrigerator. It didn't smell very good. If Henry told and Mr. Nell came down to check, he might be able to tell that something, several somethings in fact, had died in there.
If he tells,
Patrick thought, standing in the grove of pines and looking at the rusty Amana, I'll tell that he broke Eddie Kasprack's arm. Of course, they probably knew that already, but they couldn't prove anything because all of them said they had been playing out at Henry's house that day, and Henry's crazy father had backed them up.
But if he tells, I'll tell, tit for tat.
Never mind that now. What he had to do now was get rid of the bird. He would leave the refrigerator door open and then come back with the rags and the water and clean it up. Good. Patrick opened the refrigerator door on his own death. At first he was simply puzzled, unable to cope in any way with what he was seeing. It meant nothing to him at all. It had no context. Patrick merely stared, his head cocked to one side, his eyes wide. The pigeon was nothing but a skeleton surrounded by a ragged fall of feathers. There was no flesh left on its body at all. And around it, stuck on the refrigerator's inner walls, hanging from the underside of the freezer compartment, dangling from the wire shelves, were dozens of flesh-colored objects that looked like big macaroni shells. Patrick saw that they were moving slightly, fluttering, as if in a breeze. Except there was no breeze. He frowned. Suddenly one of the shell-like things unfurled insectile wings. Before Patrick could do more than register the fact, it had flown across the space between the refrigerator and Patrick's left arm. It struck with a smacking sound. There was an instant of heat. It faded and Patrick's arm felt just like always again. but the shell-like creature's pale flesh turned first pink, and then, with shocking suddenness, rose red. Although Patrick was afraid of almost nothing in the commonly understood sense of the word, it's hard to be afraid of things that aren't real, there was at least one thing that filled him with wretched loathing. He had come out of Brewster Lake one warm August day when he was 7 to discover 4 or 5 leeches clinging to his stomach and legs. He had screamed himself hoarse until his father had pulled them off. Now, in a deadly burst of inspiration, he realized that this was some weird kind of flying leech. They had infested his refrigerator. Patrick began to scream and beat at the thing on his arm. It had swelled to nearly the size of a tennis ball. At the third blow, it broke open with a sickening squat sound. Blood, his blood, sprayed his arm from elbow to wrist, but the thing's jelly-like eyeless head held on. In a way, it was like a bird's narrow head, ending in a beak-like structure, but this beak was not flat or pointed. It was tubular and blunt, like the proboscis of a mosquito. This proboscis was buried in Patrick's arm. Still screaming, he pinched the splattered creature between his fingers and pulled it off. The proboscis came out cleanly, followed by a watery flow of blood mixed with some yellowish-white liquid like pus. It had made a painless dime-sized hole in his arm. And the creature, although exploded, was still twisting and moving and seeking in his fingers. Patrick threw it away, turned, and more of them flew out of the refrigerator, lighting on him even as he groped for the Amana's handle. They landed on his hands, his arms, his neck. One touched down on his forehead. When Patrick raised his hand to pick it off, he saw 4 others on his hand, trembling minutely, turning first pink and then red. There was no pain, but there was a hideous draining sensation. Screaming, whirling, beating at his head and neck with his leech-encrusted hands, Patrick Hochstetter's mind yammered, "It isn't real. It's just a bad dream. Don't worry. It's not real. Nothing is real." But the blood pouring from the smashed leeches seemed real enough. The sound of their buzzing wings seemed real enough. And his own terror seemed real enough. One of them fell down inside his shirt and settled on his chest. While he was beating frantically at it and watching the bloodstain spread above the place where it had taken its hold, another settled on his right eye. Patrick closed it, but that did no good. He felt a brief hot flare as the thing's sucker poked through his eyelid and began to suck the fluid out of his eyeball. Patrick felt his eye collapse in its socket, and he screamed again. A leech flew into his mouth when he did and roosted on his tongue. It was all almost painless. Patrick went staggering and flapping up the path toward the junked cars. Parasites hung all over him. Some of them drank to capacity and then burst like balloons. When this happened to the bigger ones, they drenched Patrick with almost half a pint of his own hot blood. He could feel the leech inside his mouth swelling up, and he opened his jaws because the only coherent thought he had left was that it must not burst in there. It must not. But it did. Patrick ejected a huge spray of blood and parasite flesh-like vomit. He fell down in the gravelly dirt and began to roll over and over, still screaming. Little by little, the sound of his own screams began to seem faint, far away. Just before he passed out, he saw a figure step from behind the last of the junked cars. At first, Patrick thought he was a guy, Mandy Fazio, perhaps, and he would be saved. But as the figure drew closer, he saw its face was running like wax. Sometimes it began to harden and look like something or someone, and then it would start to run again, as if it couldn't make up its mind who or what it wanted to be. "Hello and goodbye," a bubbling voice said from inside the running tallow of its features, and Patrick tried to scream again. He didn't want to die. As the only real person, he wasn't supposed to die. If he did, everyone else in the world would die with him. The man-shape laid hold of his leech-encrusted arms and began to drag him away toward the barrens. His blood-stained book carrier bumped and thumped along beside him, its straps still twisted about his neck. Patrick, still trying to scream, lost consciousness. He awoke only once, when, in some dark, smelly, drippy hell where no light shone, no light at all, it began to feed. 6. At first, Beverly was not entirely sure what she was seeing or what was happening, only that Patrick Hochstetter had begun to thrash and dance and scream. She got up warily, holding the slingshot in one hand and 2 of the ball bearings in the other. She could hear Patrick blundering off down the path, still yelling his head off. In that moment, Beverly looked every inch the lovely woman she was going to become, and if Ben Hanscom had been around to see her just then, his heart might not have been able to stand it. She was standing fully upright, her head cocked to the left, her eyes wide, her hair done in braids that had been tied off with two small red velvet bows which she had bought at Dolly's for a dime. Her posture was one of total attention and concentration. It was feline, lynx-like. She had shifted forward on her left foot, her body half-turned as if to go after Patrick, and the legs of her faded shorts had pulled up enough to show the edging of her yellow cotton panties. Below them, her legs were already smoothly muscled, beautiful in spite of the scabs, bruises, and smutches of dirt. "It's a trick. He saw you, and he knows he probably can't catch you in a fair chase, so he's trying to get you to come out. Don't go, Bevy." But another part of her thought there was too much pain and fear in those screams. She wished she had seen whatever had happened to Patrick, if anything had, more clearly. She wished more than anything else that she had come into the Barrens a different way and missed the whole crazy shenanigans. Patrick's screams stopped. A moment later, Beverly heard someone speak. But she knew that had to be her imagination. She heard her father say, "Hello and goodbye." Her father wasn't even in Derry that day. He had set off for Brunswick at 8 o'clock. He and Joe Tamerley were going to pick up a Chevy truck in Brunswick. She shook her head as if to clear it. The voice didn't speak again. Her imagination, obviously. She walked out of the bushes to the path, ready to run the instant she saw Patrick charging at her, her reactions on triggers as delicate as a cat's whiskers. She looked down at the path, and her eyes widened. There was blood here, quite a lot of it. "Fake blood," her mind insisted. "You can buy a bottle of it at Dolly's for 49 cents. Be careful, Bevy." She knelt and quickly touched the blood with her fingers. She looked at them closely. It wasn't fake blood. There was a flash of heat in her left arm, just below the elbow. She looked down and saw something that she first thought was some kind of burr. No, not a burr. Burrs didn't twitch and flutter. This thing was alive. A moment after that, she realized it was biting her. She struck it hard with the back of her right hand, and it spattered, spraying blood. She backed up a step, getting ready to scream now that it was over. And then she saw that it wasn't over at all. The thing's featureless head was still on her arm, its snout buried in her flesh. With a shrill cry of disgust and fear, she picked it off and saw its proboscis come out of her arm like a small dagger, dripping with blood. She understood the blood on the path now, oh yes, and her eyes went to the refrigerator. The door had swung closed and latched again, but a number of parasites had been left outside and were crawling sluggishly over the rusty white porcelain. As Beverly looked, one of them unfurled its membranous fly-like wings and buzzed toward her. She acted without thinking, loading one of the steel ball bearings into the cup of the bullseye and pulling the sling back. As the muscles of her left arm flexed smoothly, she saw loose blood squirt from the hole the thing had made in her arm. She let fly anyway, unconsciously leading the flying thing. "Shit, missed," she thought as the bullseye snapped and the ball bearing flew, a glittering chunk of light in the hazy sun. And she would later tell the other losers that she knew she had missed it, the same way a bowler knows he has missed the strike as soon as a bad ball leaves his hand. But then she saw the ball bearing curve. It happened in a split second, but the impression was very clear. It had curved. It struck the flying thing and splattered it to mush. There was a shower of yellowish droplets which pattered on the path. Beverly backed up slowly at first, her eyes huge, her lips trembling, her face a shocked grayish-white. Her gaze was pinned to the front of the discarded refrigerator, waiting to see if any of the other things would smell or sense her. But the parasites only crawled slowly back and forth, like autumn flies drugged with the cold. At last she turned and ran. Panic beat darkly against her thoughts, but she would not give in to it entirely. She held the bullseye in her left hand and looked back over her shoulder from time to time. There was still blood dappled brightly on the path and on the leaves of some of the bushes bordering it, as if Patrick had woven from side to side as he ran. Beverly burst out into the area of junked cars again. Ahead of her there was a bigger splash of blood, just beginning to soak into the gravelly earth. The ground looked disturbed, darker streaks of earth lined into the powdery white surface, as if there had been a struggle there. Two grooves, about 2.5 feet apart, led away from the spot. Beverly halted, panting. She looked at her arm and was relieved to see that the flow of blood was finally slowing, although her lower forearm and the palm of her hand were streaked and tacky with it. The pain had begun now, a low, steady throb. It felt the way her mouth felt about an hour after the dentist's, when the Novocaine began to wear off. She looked behind again, saw nothing, then looked back at those grooves leading away from the junked cars, away from the dump, and into the Barrens. Those things were in the refrigerator. They got all over him. Sure they did. Look at all the blood. He got this far and then... Hello and goodbye. Something else happened. What? She was terribly afraid, she knew. The leeches were a part of it, and they had driven Patrick into another part of it, much as a panic-maddened steer is driven down the chute and into the slaughtering pen.
Get out of here. Get out, Bevy.
Instead, she followed the grooves in the earth, holding the bullseye tightly in her sweating hand.
At least get the others.
I will, in a little while. She walked on, following the grooves as the ground sloped down and became softer. She followed them into heavy foliage again. Somewhere a cicada burred loudly and then unwound into silence. Mosquitoes lighted on her blood-streaked arm. She waved them away. Her teeth were clenched on her lower lip. There was something lying on the ground ahead. She picked it up and looked at it. It was a handmade wallet, the sort of thing a kid might make as a crafts project at Community House. Except it was obvious to Bev that the kid who made this hadn't been much of a craftsman. The wide plastic stitching was already coming unraveled, and the bill compartment flapped like a loose mouth. She found a quarter in the change compartment. The only other thing in the wallet was a library card, made out in the name of Patrick Hockstetter. She tossed the wallet aside, library card and all. She wiped her fingers on her shorts. 50 feet farther on, she found a sneaker. The underbrush was now too dense for her to be able to follow the grooves in the earth, but you didn't have to be the pathfinder to follow the splashes and drips of blood on the bushes. The trail wound down through a steep break. Bev lost her footing once, slid, and was raked by thorns. Fresh lines of blood appeared on her upper thigh. She was breathing fast now, her hair sweaty and matted to her skull. The spots of blood led out onto one of the faint paths through the barrens. The Kanduskeag was nearby. Patrick's other sneaker, its laces bloody, lay marooned on the path. She approached the river with the bullseye sling half-drawn. The grooves in the earth had reappeared. They were shallower now. That's because he lost his sneakers, she thought. She came around a final bend and faced the river. The grooves went down the bank and led ultimately to one of those concrete cylinders, one of the pumping stations. There they stopped. The iron cover capping the top of this cylinder was a little ajar. As she stood above it, looking down, a thick and monstrous chuckle suddenly issued from beneath. It was too much. The panic which had threatened now descended. Beverly turned and fled toward the clearing and clubhouse, her bloody left arm up to shield her face from the branches which whipped and slapped her. Sometimes I worry too, Daddy, she thought wildly. Sometimes I worry a lot. 7. 4 hours later, all of the losers except Eddie crouched in the bushes near the spot where Beverly had hidden and watched Patrick Hockstetter go to the refrigerator and open it. The sky overhead had darkened with thunderheads, and the smell of rain was in the air again. Bill was holding the end of a long length of clothesline in his hands. The six of them had pooled their available cash and bought the line and a Johnson's first aid kit for Beverly. Bill had carefully affixed a gauze pad over the bloody hole in her arm.
To tell your papa Herrens you got a scrape when you were skating, Bill said. My skates, Beverly cried, dismayed. She had forgotten all about them.
There, Ben said and pointed. They were lying in a heap not far away, and she went to retrieve them before Ben or Bill or any of the others could offer. She remembered now that she had put them aside before urinating. She didn't want any of the others over there. Bill himself had tied one end of the clothesline to the handle of the Amana refrigerator, although they had all cautiously approached it together, ready to bolt at the first sign of movement. Bev had offered to give the bullseye back to Bill. He had insisted she keep it. As it turned out, nothing had moved. Although the area on the path in front of the refrigerator was splattered with blood, the parasites were gone. Perhaps they had flown away.
You could bring Chief Borton and Mr. Nell and 100 other cops down here and it still wouldn't matter, Stan Uris said bitterly. Nope, they wouldn't see a frockin' thing, Richie agreed. How's your arm, Bev?
Hurts.
She paused, looking from Bill to Richie and back to Bill again.
Would my mom and dad see the hole that thing made in my arm?
I don't think so, Bill said.
Get ready to run. I'm gonna tie it on.
He looped the end of the clothesline around the refrigerator's rust-flecked chrome handle, working with the care of a man defusing a live bomb. He tied a granny knot and then stepped back, paying out the clothesline. He grinned a small, shaky grin at the others when they had made some distance.
Whew, he said. Glad that's over.
Now, a safe, they hoped, distance from the refrigerator, Bill told them again to get ready to run. Thunder boomed directly overhead and they all jumped. The first scattered drops began to fall. Bill jerked the clothesline as hard as he could. His granny knot popped off the handle, but not before it had pulled the refrigerator door open again. An avalanche of orange pom-poms fell out, and Stan Urus uttered a painful groan. The others only stared, open-mouthed. The rain began to come harder. Thunder whip-cracked above them, making them cringe, and purplish-blue lightning flared as the refrigerator door swung all the way open. Richie saw it first, and screamed a high, hurt sound. Bill uttered some sort of angry, frightened cry. The others were silent. Written on the inside of the door, written in drying blood, were these words. "Stop now before I kill you all. A word to the wise from your friend, Pennywise." Hail mixed with the driving rain. The refrigerator door shuddered back and forth in the rising wind, the letters painted there beginning to drip and run now, taking on the draggling, ominous look of a horror movie poster. Bev was not aware that Bill had gotten up until she saw him advancing across the path toward the refrigerator. He was shaking both fists. Water streamed down his face and plastered his shirt to his back.
"Well, we're going to kill you,"
Bill screamed. Thunder whacked and cracked. Lightning flashed so brightly that she could smell it. And not far away, there was a splintering, rending sound as a tree fell.
"Bill, come back,"
Richie was yelling.
"Come back, man."
He started to get up, and Ben hauled him back down again.
"You killed my brother George, you son of a bitch, you bastard, you whoremaster. Let's see you now, let's see you now."
Hail came in a spate, stinging them even through the screening bushes. Beverly held her arm up to protect her face. She could see red welts on Ben's streaming cheeks.
"Bill, come back,"
she screamed despairingly, and another thundercrack drowned her out. It rolled across the barrens below the low black clouds.
"Let's see you come out now, you fucker."
Bill kicked wildly at the heap of pom-poms that had spilled out of the refrigerator. He turned away and began to walk back toward them, his head down. He seemed not to feel the hail, although it now covered the ground like snow. He blundered into the bushes, and Stan had to grab his arm to keep him from going into the pricker bushes. He was crying.
"That's okay, Bill,"
Ben said, putting a clumsy arm around him.
"Yeah,"
Richie said. "Don't worry. We're not going to chicken out." He stared around at them, his eyes looking wildly out of his wet face.
"Is there anyone here who's going to chicken out?"
They shook their heads. Bill looked up, wiping his eyes. They were all soaked to the skin and looked like a litter of pups that had just forded a river.
It's scared of us, you know,"
he said.
"I can feel that. I swear to God I can."
Bev nodded soberly.
"I think you're right." "Help me,"
Bill said.
"Please, help me."
"We will,"
Beverly said. She took Bill in her arms. She had not realized how easily her arms would go around him, how thin he was. She could feel his heart racing under his shirt. She could feel it next to hers. She thought that no touch had ever seemed so sweet and strong. Richie put his arms around both of them and laid his head on Beverly's shoulder. Ben did the same from the other side. Stan Urus put his arms around Richie and Ben. Mike hesitated, and then slipped one arm around Beverly's waist and the other over Bill's shivering shoulders. They stood that way, hugging, and the sleet turned back to driving, pouring rain, rain so heavy it seemed almost like a new atmosphere. The lightning walked and the thunder talked. No one spoke. Beverly's eyes were tightly shut. They stood in the rain in a huddled group, hugging each other, listening to it hiss down in the bushes. That was what she remembered best, the sound of the rain and their own shared silence and a vague sorrow that Eddie was not there with them. She remembered those things. She remembered feeling very young and very strong. Chapter 18. The Bullseye. 1.
"Okay, Haystack,"
Richie says. "Your turn. The redhead smoked all of her cigarettes and most of mine. The hour groweth late." Ben glances up at the clock.
"Yes, it's late, nearly midnight. Just time for one more story,"
he thinks.
"One more story before 12, just to keep us warm. What should it be?"
But that, of course, is only a joke, and not a very good one. There is only one story left, at least only one he remembers, and that is the story of the silver slugs, how they were made in Zach Dendro's workshop on the night of July 23rd, and how they were used on the 25th. "I've got my own scars," he says. "Do you remember?" Beverly and Eddie shake their heads. Bill and Richie nod. Mike sits silent, his eyes watchful in his tired face. Ben stands up and unbuttons the work shirt he is wearing, spreading it open. An old scar in the shape of the letter H shows there. Its lines are broken. The belly was much bigger when that scar was put there, but its shape still identifiable. The heavy scar, depending downward from the crossbar of the H, is much clearer. It looks like a twisted white hang rope from which the noose has been cut. Beverly's hand goes to her mouth. The werewolf in that house. Oh, Jesus Christ. And she turns to the windows as if to see it lurking outside in the darkness.
That's right, Ben said. And you want to know something funny? That scar wasn't there two nights ago. Henry's old calling card was. I know, because I showed it to a friend of mine. A bartender named Ricky Lee back in Hemingford home. But this one... He laughs without much humor and begins buttoning his shirt again. This one just came back.
Like the ones on our hands.
Yeah, Mike says as Ben buttons his shirt up again. The werewolf. We all saw it as the werewolf that time. Because that's how River Ritchie saw it before, Bill murmurs. That's it, isn't it?
Yes, Mike says. We were close, weren't we?
Beverly says. Her voice is softly marveling.
Close enough to read each other's minds.
Old Big Harry damn near had your guts for garters, Ben, Ritchie says, and he is not smiling as he says it.
He pushes his mended glasses up on his nose, and behind them, his face looks white and haggard and ghostly.
Bill saved your bacon, Eddie says abruptly. I mean, Bev saved us all. But if it hadn't been for you, Bill...
Yes, Ben agrees. You did, Big Bill. I was, like, lost in the funhouse.
Bill points briefly at the empty chair.
I had some help from Stan Uris, and he paid for it. Maybe died for it.
Ben Hanscom is shaking his head.
Don't say that, Bill. But it's true. And if it's your fault, it's my fault, too. And everyone else is here, because we went on. Even after Patrick and what was written on that refrigerator, we went on. It would be my fault most of all, I guess, because I wanted us to go on. Because of George. Maybe even because I thought that if I killed whatever could kill George, my parents would have to
love you again?
Beverly asks gently.
Yes, of course. But I don't think it was anyone's fault, Ben. It was just the way Stan was built.
He couldn't face it, Eddie says.
He is thinking of Mr. Keene's revelation about his asthma medicine and how he could still not give it up. He is thinking that he might have been able to give up the habit of being sick. It was the habit of believing he had been unable to kick. As things had turned out, maybe that habit had saved his life.
He was great that day, Ben says. Stan and his birds.
A chuckle stirs through them, and they look at the chair where Stan would have been in a rightful, sane world where all the good guys won all of the time.
I miss him,
Ben thinks.
God, how I miss him.
He says, you remember that day, Richie, when you told him you heard somewhere he killed Christ, and Stan says, totally deadpan, I think that was my father?
I remember,
Richie says in a voice almost too low to hear. He takes his handkerchief out of his back pocket, removes his glasses, wipes his eyes, then puts his glasses back on. He puts away the handkerchief, and without looking up from his hands, he says,
why don't you just tell it, Ben? It hurts, doesn't it?
Yeah, Richie says, his voice so thick it is hard to understand him.
Why, sure, it hurts.
Ben looks around at them, then nods.
All right, then. One more story before 12, just to keep us warm.
Bill and Richie had the idea of the bullets.
No, Richie demurs. Bill thought of it first, and he got nervous first.
I just started to worry.
Doesn't really matter, I guess, Ben says. The three of us spent some heavy library time that July. We were trying to find out how to make silver bullets. I had the silver. Four silver dollars that were my father's. Then Bill got nervous, thinking about what kind of shape we'd be in if we had a misfire with some kind of monster coming down our throats. And when we saw how good Beverly was with that slingshot of his, we ended up using one of my silver dollars to make slugs instead.
We got the stuff together, and all of us, we went down to Bill's place. Eddie, you were there.
I told my mother we were going to play Monopoly, Eddie says. My arm was really hurting, but I had to walk. That's how pissed she was at me. And every time I heard someone behind me on the sidewalk, I'd whip around, thinking it was Bowers. It didn't help the pain.
Bill grins. And what we did was stand around and watch Ben make the ammo.
I think Ben really could have made silver bullets.
Oh, I'm not so sure of that, Ben says, although he still is. He remembers how the dusk was drawing down outside. Mr. Denbrough had promised them all rides home. The sound of the crickets in the grass, the first lightning bugs blinking outside the windows.
Bill had carefully set up the Monopoly board in the dining room, making it look as if the game had been going on for an hour or more.
He remembers that, and the clean pool of yellow light falling on Zach's work table.
He remembers Bill saying, "We gotta be cuckoo."
Two. Careful.
I don't want to leave a mess. My dad'll be...
He spat out a number of P's and finally managed to say, "Pissed off." Richie made a burlesque of wiping his cheek. "Do you serve towels with your shower, stuttering Bill?" Bill made as if to hit him. Richie cowered, shrieking in his pickaninny voice. Ben took very little notice of them. He watched Bill lay out the implements and tools one by one in the light. Part of his mind was wishing that someday he might have such a nice work table as this himself. Most of it was centered directly on the job ahead. Not as difficult as making silver bullets would have been, but he would still be careful. There was no excuse for sloppy workmanship. This was not something he had been taught or told, just something he knew. Bill had insisted that Ben make the slugs, just as he continued to insist that Beverly would be the one carrying the bullseye. These things could have and had been discussed, but it was only 27 years later, telling the story, that Ben realized no one had even suggested that a silver bullet or slug might not stop a monster. They had the weight of what seemed like 1,000 horror movies on their side.
"Okay," Ben said. He cracked his knuckles and then looked at Bill. "You got the molds?"
"Oh," Bill jumped a little.
"Here."
He reached into his pants pocket and brought out his handkerchief. He put it on the workbench and unfolded it. There were two dull steel balls inside, each with a small hole in it. They were bearing molds. After deciding on slugs instead of bullets, Bill and Richie had gone back to the library and had researched how bearings were made.
"You boys are so busy," Mrs. Sterrett had said. "Bullets one week and bearings the next. And it's summer vacation, too."
"We'd like to stay sharp," Richie said. "Right, Bill?"
Right.
It turned out that making bearings was a cinch once you had the molds. The only real question was where to get them. A couple of discreet questions to Zach Denbrough had taken care of that, and none of the losers were too surprised to find that the only machine shop in Derry where such molds might be obtained was Kitchener Precision Tool and Die. The Kitchener who owned and ran it was a great-great-grandnephew of the brothers who had owned the Kitchener Ironworks. Bill and Richie had gone over together with all the cash the losers had been able to raise on short notice, $10.59. In Bill's pocket. When Bill asked how much a couple of 2-inch bearing molds might cost, Carl Kitchener, who looked like a veteran booze hound and smelled like an old horse blanket, asked what a couple of kids wanted with bearing molds. Richie let Bill speak, knowing things would probably go easier that way. Children made fun of Bill's stutter. Adults were embarrassed by it. Sometimes this was surprisingly helpful. Bill got halfway through the explanation he and Richie had worked out on the way over, something about a model windmill for next year's science project, when Kitchener waved for him to shut up and quoted them the unbelievable price of 50 cents per mold. Hardly able to believe their good fortune, Bill forked over a single dollar bill.
"Don't expect me to give you a bag," Carl Kitchener said, eyeing them with the bloodshot contempt of a man who believes he has seen everything the world holds, most of it twice. "You don't get no bag unless you spend at least $5.
"That's okay, sir, Bill said.
"And don't hang around out front," Kitchener said. "You both need haircuts."
Outside, Bill said, You ever notice, Richie, how grown-ups won't sell you anything except candy or comic books or maybe movie tickets without first they will want to know what you want it for?"
"Sure," Richie said.
"Well, why? Why is that?"
"Because they think we're dangerous."
"Yeah? You think so?"
"Yeah," Richie said, and then giggled.
"Let's hang around out front, want to? We'll put up our collars and sneer at people and let our hair grow." fuck you, you, Bill said.
3. Okay, Ben said, looking at the molds carefully and then putting them down.
Good. Now...
They gave him a little more room, looking at him hopefully, the way a man with engine trouble who knows nothing about cars will look at a mechanic. Ben didn't notice their expressions. He was concentrating on the job.
Give me that shell, he said, and the blowtorch.
Bill handed a cut-down mortar shell to him. It was a war souvenir. Zack had picked it up 5 days after he and the rest of General Patton's army had crossed the river into Germany. There had been a time, when Bill was very young and George was still in diapers, that his father had used it as an ashtray. Later, he had quit smoking, and the mortar shell had disappeared. Bill had found it in the back of the garage just a week ago. Ben put the mortar shell into Zack's vise, tightened it, and then took the blowtorch from Beverly. He reached into his pocket, brought out a silver dollar, and dropped it into the makeshift crucible. It made a hollow sound.
Your father gave you that, didn't he? Beverly asked.
Yes, Ben said, but I don't remember him very well.
Are you sure you want to do this?
He looked at her and smiled.
Yes, he said.
She smiled back. It was enough for Ben. If she had smiled at him twice, he would gladly have made enough silver bearings to shoot a platoon of werewolves. He looked hastily away.
Okay, here we go. No problem. Easy as pie, right?
They nodded hesitantly. Years later, recounting all of this, Ben would think,
these days a kid could just run out and buy a propane torch, or his dad would have one in the workshop.
There had been no such things in 1958, however. Zack Denbro had a tank job, and it made Beverly nervous. Ben could tell she was nervous, wanted to tell her not to worry, but was afraid his voice would tremble.
Don't worry,
he said to Stan, who was standing next to her.
Huh?
Stan said, looking at him and blinking.
Don't worry.
I'm not.
Oh, I thought you were. And I just wanted you to know this is perfectly safe. If you were. Worrying, I mean.
Are you okay, Ben?
Fine, Ben muttered. Give me the matches, Richie.
Richie gave him a book of matches. Ben twisted the valve on the tank and lit a match under the nozzle of the torch. There was a flump and a bright blue-orange glare. Ben tuned the flame to a blue edge and began to heat the base of the mortar shell.
You got the funnel?
He asked Bill.
Rubber right here.
Bill handed over a homemade funnel that Ben had made earlier. The tiny hole at its base fit the hole in the bearing molds almost exactly. Ben had done this without taking a single measurement. Bill had been amazed, almost flabbergasted, but did not know how to say so without embarrassing Ben. Absorbed in what he was doing, Ben could talk to Beverly. He spoke with the dry precision of a surgeon addressing a nurse.
Bev, you've got the steadiest hands. Stick the funnel in the hole. Use one of those gloves so you don't get burned.
Bill handed her one of his father's work gloves. Beverly put the tin funnel in the mold. No one spoke. The hissing of the blowtorch flame seemed very loud. They watched it, eyes squinted almost shut.
Well, wait,
Bill said suddenly, and dashed into the house. He came back a minute later with a pair of cheap turtle wraparound sunglasses that had been languishing in a kitchen drawer for a year or more.
Better put these on, Haystack.
Ben took them, grinned, and slipped them on.
Shit, it's Fabian, Richie said, or Frankie Avalon, or one of those bandstand wops.
Fuck you, trash mouth, Ben said,
but he started giggling in spite of himself. The idea of him being Fabian or someone like that was just too weird. The flame wavered, and he stopped laughing. His concentration narrowed to a point again. 2 minutes later, he handed the torch to Eddie, who held it gingerly in his good hand.
It's ready, he said to Bill. Give me that other glove, fast, fast.
Bill gave it to him. Ben put it on and held the mortar shell with the gloved hand while he turned the vice lever with the other.
Hold it steady, Bev.
I'm ready. Don't wait for me,
she rapped back at him. Ben tilted the shell over the funnel. The others watched as a rivulet of molten silver flowed between the two receptacles. Ben poured precisely. Not a drop was spilled. And for a moment he felt galvanized. He seemed to see everything magnified through a strong white glow. For that one moment, he did not feel like plain, fat old Ben Hanscom, who wore sweatshirts to disguise his gut and his tits. He felt like Thor, working thunder and lightning at the smithy of the gods. Then the feeling was gone.
Okay, he said. I'm going to have to reheat the silver. Someone shove a nail or something up the spout of the funnel before the goop hardens in there.
Stan did it. Ben clamped the mortar shell in the vise again and took the torch from Eddie.
Okay, he said. Number 2.
And went back to work. 4. 10 minutes later, it was done. Now what? Mike asked. Now we play Monopoly for an hour, Ben said, while they harden in the molds. Then I clip them open with a chisel along the cut lines and we're done. Richie looked uneasily at the cracked face of his Timex, which had taken a great many lickings and kept on ticking. When will your folks be back, Bill?
Not until 10 or 10:30, Bill said. It's a double feature at the Aladdin, Stan said.
Yeah.
And they'll stop in for a slice of pizza after. They almost always do.
So we have plenty of time, Ben said.
Bill nodded.
Then let's go in, Bev said. I want to call home. I promised I would.
And don't any of you talk. He thinks I'm at Community House and that I'm getting a ride home from there.
What if he wants to come down and pick you up early? Mike asked.
Then, Beverly said, I'm going to be in a lot of trouble.
Ben thought, I'd protect you, Beverly.
In his mind's eye, an instant daydream unfolded, one with an ending so sweet he shivered. Bev's father started to give her a hard time, to bawl her out and all that. Even in his daydream, he did not imagine how bad all that could get with Al Marsh. Ben threw himself in front of her and told Marsh to lay off.
If you want trouble, fat boy, you just keep protecting my daughter.
Hanscom, usually a quiet, bookish type, can be a ravening tiger when you get him mad. He speaks to Al Marsh with great sincerity.
If you want to get to her, you'll have to come through me first.
Marsh starts forward, and then the steely glint in Hanscom's eyes stops him.
You'll be sorry, he mumbles, but it's clear all the fight has gone out of him. He's just a paper tiger after all.
Somehow I doubt that, Hanscom says with a tight Gary Cooper smile, and Beverly's father slinks away.
What's happened to you, Ben?
Bev cries, but her eyes are shining and full of stars.
You looked ready to kill him.
Kill him? Hanscom says, the Gary Cooper smile still lingering on his lips.
No way, baby. He may be a creep, but he's still your father. I might have roughed him up a little, but that's only because when someone talks wrong to you, I get a little hot under the collar, you know?
She throws her arms around him and kisses him.
On the lips. On the lips. I love you, Ben,
she sobs. He can feel her small breast pressing firmly against his chest and... He shivered a little, throwing this bright, terribly clear picture off with an effort. Richie stood in the doorway, asking him if he was coming, and Ben realized he was all alone in the workroom.
Yeah,
he said, starting a little. Sure I am.
You're going senile, Haystack,
Richie said as Ben went through the door, but he clapped Ben on the shoulder. Ben grinned and hooked an elbow briefly around Richie's neck. 5. There was no problem with Beverly's dad. He had come home late from work, Bev's mother told her over the phone, fallen asleep in front of the TV, and waked up just long enough to get himself into bed.
You got a ride home, Bevy?
Yes, Bill Denbrough's dad is going to take a whole bunch of us home.
Mrs. Marsh sounded suddenly alarmed.
You're not on a date, are you, Bevy?
No, of course not,
Bev said, looking through the arched doorway between the darkened hall where she was and the dining room, where the others were sitting down around the Monopoly board.
But I sure wish I was.
Boys, uck. But they have a sign-up sheet down here, and every night a different dad or mom takes kids home.
That much at least was true. The rest was a lie so outrageous that she could feel herself blushing hotly in the dark.
All right, her mom said. I just wanted to be sure. Because if your dad caught you going on dates at your age, he'd be mad.
Almost as an afterthought, she added, I would be too.
Yeah, I know.
Bev said, still looking into the dining room.
She did know. Yet here she was, not with one boy, but 6 of them, in a house where the parents were gone.
She saw Ben looking at her anxiously, and she sketched a smiling little salute at him. He blushed, but gave her the little salute right back.
Are any of your girlfriends there?
What girlfriends, Mama?
Patty O'Hara's here, and Ellie Geiger, I think. She's playing shuffleboard downstairs.
The facility with which the lies came from her lips made her ashamed. She wished she were talking to her father. She would have been more scared, but less ashamed. She supposed she really wasn't a very good girl.
I love you, Mama, she said.
Same goes back to you, Bev.
Her mother paused briefly and added,
Be careful. The paper says there may be another one, a boy named Patrick Hochstetter. He's missing. Did you know him, Bevy?
She closed her eyes briefly.
No, Mom.
Well, goodbye, then.
Bye.
She joined the others at the table, and for an hour they played Monopoly. Stan was the big winner.
Jews are very good at making money,
Stan said, putting a hotel on Atlantic Avenue and two more green houses on Ventnor Avenue. Everybody knows that.
Jesus, make me Jewish,
Ben said promptly, and everyone laughed. Ben was almost broke. Beverly glanced across the table from time to time at Bill, noting his clean hands, his blue eyes, the fine red hair. As he moved the little silver shoe he was using as a marker around the board, she thought,
if he held my hand, I think I'd be so glad I'd probably die.
A warm light seemed to glow briefly in her chest, and she smiled secretly down at her hands. 6. The evening's finale was almost anticlimactic. Ben took one of Zach's chisels from the shelf and used a hammer to strike the molds on the cut lines. They opened easily. Two small silver balls fell out. In one, they could faintly see part of a date, 9/25. In the other, wavery lines Beverly thought were the remnants of Lady Liberty's hair. They looked at them without speaking for a moment, and then Stan picked one up.
Pretty small, he said.
So was the rock in David's sling when he went up against Goliath, Mike said.
They look powerful to me.
Ben found himself nodding. They did to him as well.
We're all to the done?
Bill asked.
All done, Ben said.
Here. He tossed the second slug to Bill, who was so surprised he almost fumbled it. The slugs went around the circle. Each of them looked closely at both, marveling at their roundness, weight, actuality. When they came back to Ben, he held them in his hand and then looked at Bill.
What do we do with them now?
Give them to Beverly.
No.
He looked at her. His face was kind enough, but stern.
Bev, we've been through this already, and...
I'll do it, she said. I'll shoot the goddamn things when the time comes, if it comes. I'll probably get us all killed, but I'll do it. I don't want to take them home, though. One of my...
Father.
Parents might find them. Then I'd be in Dutch.
Don't you have a secret hiding place?
Richie asked.
Criminy. I got 4 or 5.
I've got a place, Beverly said.
There was a small slit in the bottom of her box spring where she sometimes stashed cigarettes, comic books, and just lately, film and fashion magazines.
But nothing I'd trust for something like this. You keep them, Bill, until it's time anyway. You keep them.
Okay, Bill said mildly, and just then light splashed into the driveway.
Holy crow, they're early. Let's get out of here.
They were just sitting down around the Monopoly board again when Sharon Denbro opened the kitchen door. Richie rolled his eyes and mimed wiping sweat from his forehead. The others laughed heartily. Richie had gotten off a good one. A moment later, she came in.
Your dad's waiting for your friends in the car, Bill.
Okay, my mom, Bill said.
Well, we were just finishing anyway.
Who won?
Sharon asked, smiling bright-eyed at Bill's little friends. The girl was going to be very pretty, she thought. She supposed in another year or two the children would have to be chaperoned if there were going to be girls instead of just the regular gang of boys. But surely it was still too soon to worry about sex rearing its ugly head.
Stan Wubble won, Bill said. Jews are very good at making money.
Bill,
she cried, horrified and blushing. And then she looked around at them, amazed, as they roared with laughter, Stan included. Amazement turned to something like fear, although she said nothing of this to her husband later, in bed. There was a feeling in the air, like static electricity, only somehow much more powerful, much more scary. She felt that if she touched any of them, she would receive a walloping shock.
What's happened to them?
She thought, dismayed, and perhaps she even opened her mouth to say something like that. Then Bill was saying he was sorry, but still with that devilish glint in his eye, and Stan was saying that was all right. It was just a joke they laid on him from time to time, and she found herself too confused to say anything at all. But she felt relieved when the children were gone and her own puzzling, stuttering son had gone to his room and turned off the light. 7. The day that the Losers Club finally met it in face-to-face combat, the day it almost had Ben Hanscom's guts for garters, was July 25th, 1958. It was hot and muggy and still. Bill remembered the weather clearly enough. It had been the last day of the hot weather. After that day, a long spell of cool and cloudy had come in. They arrived at 29 Nebold Street around 10 that morning, Bill riding Richie double on Silver, Ben with his ample buttocks spilling over either side of the sagging seat on his Raleigh. Beverly came down Nebold Street on her girl Schwinn, her red hair held back from her forehead by a green band. It streamed out behind her. Mike came by himself, and about 5 minutes later, Stan and Eddie walked up together.
How's your arm, Eddie?
Oh, not too bad. Hurts if I roll over on that side while I'm sleeping.
Did you bring the stuff?
There was a canvas-wrapped bundle in Silver's bike basket. Bill took it out and unwrapped it. He handed the slingshot to Beverly, who took it with a little grimace but said nothing. There was also a tin Sucrets box in the bundle. Bill opened it and showed them the two silver balls. They looked at them silently, gathered close together on the balding lawn on 29 Niebolt Street, a lawn where only weeds seemed to grow. Bill, Richie, and Eddie had seen the house before. The others hadn't, and they looked at it curiously.
The windows look like eyes, Stan thought, and his hand went to the paperback book in his back pocket.
He touched it for luck. He carried the book with him almost everywhere. It was M.K. Handy's Guide to North American Birds. They look like dirty blind eyes.
It stinks, Beverly thought. I can smell it, but not with my nose, not exactly.
Mike thought, it's like that time out where the ironworks used to be. It has the same feel as if it's telling us to step on in.
This is one of its places, all right, Ben thought. One of the places like the Morlock holes, where it goes out and comes back in, and it knows we're out here. It's waiting for us to come in.
You all still want to? Bill asked. They looked back at him, pale and solemn. No one said no. Yet he fumbled his aspirator out of his pocket and took a long, whooping gasp at it.
Gimme some of that, Richie said.
Eddie looked at him, surprised, waiting for the punchline. Richie held out his hand.
No fake, Jake. Can I have some?
Eddie shrugged with his good shoulder, an oddly disjointed movement, and handed it over. Richie triggered the aspirator and breathed deep.
Needed that, he said, and handed it back.
He was coughing a little, but his eyes were sober.
Me too, Stan said. Okay?
So one after another, they used Eddie's aspirator. When it came back to him, Eddie jammed it in his back pocket where the nozzle stuck out. They turned to look at the house again.
Does anybody live on this street? Beverly asked in a low voice.
Not this end of it, Mike said. Not anymore. Just the bums that stay for a while and then go out on the freights.
They wouldn't see anything, Stan said. They'd be safe.
Most of them, anyway. He looked at Bill. Can any grown-ups at all see it, do you think, Bill?
I don't know, Bill said. There must be some.
I wish we could meet one, Richie said glumly. This really isn't a job for kids, you know what I mean?
Bill knew. Whenever the Hardy boys got into trouble, Fenton Hardy was around to bail them out. Same with Rick Brandt's dad, Hartson, in the Rick Brandt Science Adventures. Shit, even Nancy Drew had a father who would show up in the nick of time if the bad guys tied her up and threw her into an abandoned mine or something.
Ought to be a grown-up along, Richie said, looking at the closed house with its peeling paint, its dirty windows, its shadowy porch.
He sighed tiredly. For a moment, Ben felt their resolution falter. Then Bill said,
"Kakahum around her here. Look at this."
They walked around to the left side of the porch, where the skirting was torn off. The brambly run to the wild roses were still there, and those Eddie's leper had touched when it climbed out were still black and dead.
"It just touched them and it did that?"
Beverly asked, horrified. Bill nodded.
"Are you guys sure?
For a moment, nobody replied. They weren't sure. Even though all of them knew by Bill's face that he would go on without them, they weren't sure. There was also a species of shame on Bill's face. As he had told them before, George hadn't been their brother.
But all the other kids, Ben thought. Betty Ripsom, Cheryl LaMonica, that Clemens kid, Eddie Corcoran, maybe, Ronnie Grogan, even Patrick Hochstetter. It kills kids, goddammit, kids.
I'll go, Big Bill, he said.
Shit, yeah, Beverly said.
Sure, Richie said. You think we're going to let you have all the fun, Mushmouth?
Bill looked at them, his throat working, and then he nodded. He handed the tin box to Beverly.
Are you sure, Bill?
Sure.
She nodded, at once horrified by the responsibility and bewitched by his trust. She opened the box, took out the slugs, and slipped one into the right front pocket of her jeans. The other she socketed into the bullseye's rubber cup, and it was by the cup that she carried the slingshot. She could feel the ball tightly enclosed in her fist, cold at first and then warming.
"Let's go," she said, her voice not quite steady. "Let's go before I chicken out."
Bill nodded, then looked sharply at Eddie.
"Can you do this, Eddie?"
Eddie nodded. "Sure I can. I was alone last time. This time I'm with my friends, right?" He looked at them and grinned a little. His expression was shy, fragile, and quite beautiful. Richie clapped him on the back.
"That's right, Senhor. Anyone tries to steal your assoparator, we kill him. But we kill him slow."
"That's terrible, Richie," Bev said, giggling.
Under the porch, Bill said. All of you behind me. Then into the cellar.